It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 73 for Friday, the 27th of April, 2012. On the show today... Last week, we picked a juicy fruit from the Wired news tree, which concerned a new company called Planetary Resources. But this week, we're able to peel that fruit and explain how it intends to add, quote, trillions of dollars to the global GDP. Plus, why are we so interested in visiting places with dark histories such as Chernobyl? The University of Central Lancashire is launching a dark tourism research centre to find out. And as Google backs a so-called social network for former violent extremists, we delve into the world of niche networking to find out why such forums exist. All that and more coming up. Ahoy there, Nate Langson here, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, news editor Duncan of Gear.
Hello.
And of course, Livia underscore Solon.
Hello.
I think that came out Livia.
Yeah.
Not Olivia.
Olivia.
Which is weird because we don't call you Olivia.
No.
You are Liv.
I am.
Well, anyway, welcome to you all. Duncan, you've been on the roof of our office today, I can't help noticing, quite a lot.
Quite actually. A lot, yeah, for about an hour this afternoon.
What are you doing up there?
I'm installing some weather stations.
Are these, I've seen those with the little egg cups.
Yeah, anemometers, we call them in the trade.
In the trade.
Yeah.
Journalism trade.
we're installing four weather stations up there for a future test in the magazine.
Interesting. I did wonder what you were doing about that. I didn't realise we could get quite so high up on our building. Like, you think it's just wired, but then it's not. It's wired plus roof plus another bit. You can see all of London.
There's kind of stairs. Yeah, the view is amazing.
Well.
Pretty amazing. Well, we've got that established. Let's get on with some news, shall we? Now, last week we talked about this firm called Planetary Resources, which was rumoured to be intending to do something in space that would, quote, create a new industry by mixing space exploration with the harvesting of natural resources to add trillions of dollars to the global GDP.
And we said that was probably asteroid mining.
We did say it was probably asteroid mining. And do you know what it's turned out to be, Liv?
Asteroid mining.
The mining of asteroids. It's a company called Planetary Resources, and the plan, they have said, is to send swarms of robots into space to latch onto asteroids that contain precious metals, like platinum, blow them up with mines, and bring the contents back to Earth. Not even remotely audacious or out there.
It sounds very Bond villain-esque, doesn't it? You can just imagine this being the threat, and I'm going to take all the resources.
It is a bit, but there are no villains involved here, at least none that we know of. The company's co-founder is Eric Anderson, who founded Space Tourism, which... he didn't. He founded the space tourism firm, Space Adventures, which sells tickets to private individuals for like orbital space flights, and I think they're going to the moon, or would like to go to the moon. And another co-founder, interestingly, is Peter Diamandis, who started the XPRIZE Foundation, which offers prize-based incentives for people who can come up with, you know, advanced technology developments and things like that. So it's quite interesting. Plus, Google CEO or ex-CEO Eric Schmidt, I think, is backing this as
Chairman, I think he is now, isn't he?
Chairman of the board, yeah. Mm. So some interesting names involved. They plan over the next 18 to 24 months to launch between 2 and 5 space-based telescopes at an estimated cost of several £100,000 each that hopefully can identify the first possible asteroids that they could send probes to blow the hell out of.
And there's quite a lot of potential asteroids up there. There's nearly 9,000 of them, larger than 45 metres in diameter or so, near Earth, that could contain as much platinum as is mined in an entire year in Earth. Each one could contain that amount. So they're potentially worth hundreds of millions of pounds each. So
I presume, though, that it would make the value of platinum plummet.
That
is an aspect of it. Yeah, as all this sort of stuff comes back to Earth, it will have an effect on our commodity prices.
Yeah, well, within the next 5 to 7 years, they want to send out smaller swarms of similar spacecraft, but this time for kind of for a more prospective detailing mission, if you like, mapping out valuable asteroids in detail to find exactly what they've got stored inside their juicy veins.
Are there any kind of particular things that we're looking for that we're rapidly running out of on Earth?
Well, I think they want platinum. I mean, we're certainly running out of oil, but that's not what we're going to get from asteroids.
Yeah. There won't be many oil on asteroids.
I think it's mostly precious metals.
They're after the platinum group metals, which is platinum, palladium, and osmium, and iridium. And these kinds of things are used in medical devices, in renewable energy products, in catalytic converters, that sort of thing. And also maybe in fuel cells for cars.
Yeah,
it's quite interesting that they're planning on refining the ore up there and bringing it back to Earth. It sounds like it would probably be probably be easier to do the actual refining on Earth.
Have they given much in the way of kind of details on how they're going to do that?
Not exactly, no. And no one's done it before, which makes it even more complicated. Although there was a paper published by the NASA JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, earlier this year, and they tried to basically gauge the feasibility of this sort of a project. And they concluded that although the technology exists, a plan would probably need something like £1.6 billion just in funding to get it going, which would mean that the initial investment would be, well, literally astronomical, you know, figuratively and literally. So I don't know. It could be that asteroid mining is the sort of thing that future generations will be able to do more successfully while we've got, you know, when we've got more established, I don't know, moon bases. We've talked about inflatable moon bases before. Or maybe if someone likes Space Adventures or, you know, who is it, Space Adventures that's doing the Mars, potential Mars trip? Were we talking about those the other week? Was it somebody else?
No, that was the guy from Tesla Motors called...
Elon Musk?
Yes.
Elon Musk, yeah. So, I don't know. When we have more of those, perhaps, then it becomes more feasible. But either way, it's years and years away before we'll potentially see anything, and they may need several billion pounds of investment to begin with. But it's exciting.
So if you want to chuck a tenner their way, then do.
Yeah, it'd be great if this was on Kickstarter, actually. Can you imagine that? The returns you could possibly get for your great-great-great-grandchildren. Okay, well... actually, let's stay on the topic of Google slightly, because Google has backed a, quote, social network for former violent extremists. Liv, this is a story you wrote this week, and it's fascinating.
Yes, it's called Against Violent Extremism, and it kind of... The idea is to bring together people who've been violent extremists, be they gang members or neo-Nazis or, you know, Islamic extremists, and who've turned them, you know, turned their lives around, and then and they can kind of share... how they did it with others, with the idea of inspiring other people to do it as well.
So a little bit like Alcoholics Anonymous sort of idea, but for, you know, extremism and neo-Nazis, people
yeah,
like that.
A little bit. I mean, leaving a violent extremist group, whatever type it is, it can be incredibly difficult and it takes a lot of bravery to do it. And quite often you are left with no social network whatsoever. And this kind of helps put that into place. And you don't have, you probably will need to find a new job, new housing, new support structure. And this sort of idea could provide that.
And who's behind it?
Well, it's Google Ideas, which is an interesting kind of arm where they do kind of big projects to solve the world's problems. And they kind of had the idea at an event last year in Dublin. And then since then, they've been working with the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, which is like a political think tank based in London, Gen Next Foundation and Rehab Studio to build it.
And I think they've actually got people already... signed up.
They've got about 395 people signed up. It's not just the former extremists, it's also their victims and people working in the kind of charitable organizations and policymakers around this sort of topic.
What about goals? I mean, the thing that interests me about this is that I know they wanted to get 500 members by the end of their first year.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that doesn't seem too out of the realms of possibility, given they've got almost 400 so far.
Yeah, I think the point is they're not trying to make this, you know, anyone can join up and just have a squiz if they wanted to. It's really very much about kind of vetting people to ensure that they are the right sort of person and then trying to actually really affect change through it.
Mm. I mean, it is. I mean, I don't know. Is it a sustainable thing? Is it even a business? It's not a business.
No,
such,
it's not. It's not a business. It's a non-profit, and it's not no affiliations with any government, which I think is a good thing because it means there's obviously no political affiliations.
Mm. Interesting. So we'll keep our eye on this and maybe report back in 6 months' time, see if they've hit their 500-person goal.
Yeah.
But you've got a story on the site. I think if you search for Against Violent Extremism, there's a really interesting story in there with lots of background on how it came to be. Duncan, the University of Central Lancashire has launched a dark tourism research centre. This caught my eye because I like the morbid and the macabre.
Why do you like the morbid and the macabre?
Come on, you know. Because, you know... I don't know, actually.
Well, they're trying to find out. They're trying to find out exactly that. They're trying to find out why people are compelled to visit these macabre hotspots like Chernobyl, like Auschwitz, like Ground Zero, and also see things like the Body Worlds exhibition where you can kind of see inside the human body in slightly grisly sorts of ways.
Oh, yeah, a bit like the Animal Inside Out thing.
Exactly
like
the Animal Inside Out
thing. Where they plastinate the bodies of elephants and stuff.
Yeah, so this is a research institute that they've set up to try and find out why people are fascinated with visiting places like this. It's a very under-researched area. area of sociology and psychology. And it's going to be headed up by Philip Stone, who's researched a lot of these places before and published stuff on this subject. And he said it's all about the issues surrounding the promotion and the management of dark sites or attractions and the relationship between dark tourism and the broader cultural condition of contemporary society.
I see. For me, I would want to go to Chernobyl because the photographic opportunities over there are numerous. It's a fascinating place. I've seen some many photo stories, like because of the actual, you know, the buildings and stuff that they've got around there.
It's very kind of stark, isn't it? There's a certain quality to it.
It's got a genuine 1984 feel, to be perfectly honest.
It does.
Okay. Well, I've established that. That's why I would want to go. What about you, Liv? Are there any sort of incredibly morbid places you'd want to go and hang out?
I don't know. I do find all this really, all of these places really fascinating. And in the same way that I love looking at, like, watching horrible movies and, you know, like, looking at gross things. I don't know. I think there's something that kind of you really appreciate.
It's rubbernecky, isn't it?
It is. But I think there's something about you appreciate your own mortality and that you're able to appreciate your, you know, the fact that you're still alive and still okay more. What I want to know is what sort of studies are going to take place. Like, what science are we looking at here? What are the actual, what things are they going to be looking at?
Well, I guess it's kind of about, as he said, it's kind of about the management of these dark sites and how you promote it in a way that isn't sort of offensive. That's one aspect of it. Yeah. And there's also the kind of aspect of why people go to these places.
That's true.
But what are they going to be doing? Are they going to be interviewing people? Are they going to be analysing what the place looks like? I'm just trying to.
I'm sure. All those things will be part of it.
I think it must be. And I suppose it has to be. There's a sociological angle to it as well. You know, why are humans fascinated by the morbid?
But is it just the morbid, or is it just these places are of incredible historical significance, whether they're morbid or not morbid?
Well, Auschwitz is, but I mean, the London Dungeon isn't really that historical. Well, I suppose it is, but now it's more of a, it's more like something out of Alton Towers than anything historically accurate, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, it's still going and seeing a place where some really nasty stuff happened. And there's that question of why do people want to see nasty stuff? I think that's what's central towards
this. I feel like that when I walk down Fleet Street. Some nasty stuff happened there. Sorry, that was slightly too political. Okay, well, I suppose we don't have a time frame for when this sort of study is going to come out, but we'll...
Yeah, I mean, they've just launched this institute. I don't think they've worked out any specific studies yet.
Mm. Okay, well, let's move on. So, three strikes, the law that would dictate whether or not you got your internet cut off because you were downloading illicit copyrighted materials. The timetable from the Department of Culture, or for Culture, Media and Sport, has revealed that warning letters that are to be sent to file sharers won't begin to be sent out until 2014, which is possibly, I think, 3 years since they were initially scheduled to go out.
Yeah, I mean, this is all the fallout from the Digital Economy Act, which was passed in the wash-up at the end of the Labour administration in 2010. And that set out a graduated response sort of setup where you'd get a letter saying you've been file sharing, and then you, if you carried on doing it, you'd get a second letter, which would probably be a little angrier. Mm. And then the third one, then they could institute technical measures. And I say that in quotation marks because nobody's actually worked out what those technical measures are. They could be cutting off your internet, but it might just be something like slowing down your access at certain points of the day.
Or sending a robot out to like slap you on the hand and then retreat.
That's what the Hodopi thing was in France. I mean, they've had three strikes in place now for quite some time.
Yeah.
And there's been so much pushback over here from the likes of BT and TalkTalk and the major ISPs that it's basically unfeasible. And there's a lot of skepticism around how this system would technically operate, you know, and who's going to pay for it. Mm. You know, and like you say, Duncan, the technical measures, what are they? Is it cutting off? Is it slower speeds?
I think there's also the aspect of that there's actually not very much political will among the coalition government to prop up what's seen very much as Labour legislation, and while there's still a huge amount of pressure from the cultural industries to try and you know, get this moving, the challenges, the unsuccessful legal challenges from BT and TalkTalk have pushed it back so far that it's likely that we'll probably see an update to 2003's Communications Act and push in legislation to tackle in some way file sharing through that, rather than using the framework of the Digital Economy Act. I think that one might sink into history.
So what we're saying here is that it's unlikely perhaps to happen at all, and if it does, it's not for 2 years. So what, file share away?
I'm not sure I could go as far as saying that, but I mean, I think it's right now it's looking a little bit wobbly, and they're putting it very, very far in the future. So we'll see what happens.
And possibly the fact that in light of recent mass protests against other pieces of legislation like ACTA, SOPA and PIPA, that it might be seen as a very unpopular piece of legislation to rush through at this
stage.
We're
in a completely different political climate in terms of kind of these aspects of policy right now.
Yeah. Mm.
Hold your horses. The Shire is not ready to canter. Well, we're going to take a quick ad break, but when we come back, why is it so wet even though we're having a drought?
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Welcome back. Glorious little ad break there. Duncan had some issue with what I said before the ad break.
Yeah, you said why... what was it you exactly said?
I said, why is it so wet,
even though we're supposedly having a drought?
Yeah, it should be the other way around. Why are we having a drought even though it's so wet? The drought should come after the wet, surely, or it shouldn't.
I just think that
the point is, it's wet, but we're supposedly having a drought.
Yeah, discuss. So Duncan, you have a degree in meteorology. You are the wet weather gear. You have been on the roof installing weather monitoring stations all day. I mean, you are a man obsessed with wetness.
All right.
The rain, stuff coming
unrelenting,
out.
You know, terrible
even,
weather.
Even live editing my links between the podcasts. What's going on? Why is it so alf moist out?
So what?
So moist.
Well, because it's April, and in April we always get April showers.
But we're having a drought.
Yeah, but that's nothing to do with whether it's actually raining or not.
Okay, tell me about the news. What's going on?
So over the past few weeks, I've lost count of the amount of people who've made sarcastic comments about us being in drought, despite the fact it's been tipping it down. And I just kind of wanted to explain to some of the listeners who may not be aware of the difference between a wet fortnight in April and a two-year-long drought that we've been having. In 2011 alone, England and Wales only got about 80% of the rain that it normally gets. So for every 5 cups of water that would fall from the sky normally, we only got 4. Now, that doesn't sound too bad, but it's actually much, much worse in the south and southeast, which is where we've got significant drought. We get the vast majority of our drinking water down here from underground aquifers, which are these stores of groundwater deep, deep, deep below the earth. And it takes quite some time for water to filter down there. And if we've got only 80% of the rain that we normally have over a long period of time, it was before 2011 as well. We've been having very, very low rainfall for quite some time now. The reserves that we've got down here are pretty much empty, and so a couple of weeks of April showers, which we get this time of year anyway, aren't really going to fill up the country's water reserves.
Would it not be making sense, though, for us to be catching the rainwater and processing it so that we can use the rainwater for drinking?
Yes, and it's possible to do that on small scales. I mean, lots of people have a barrel in their garden that's set up to catch rainwater and use it for crops or whatever. But drinking water, it's a bit more difficult to do that for, especially over a large scale. And the other aspect is when the ground is dry, which it is very much at the moment, water doesn't soak into it; it runs off it instead. It hardens, and the water runs into a river and out to sea, and sometimes it causes flooding along the way. So when you've had lots and lots of dry weather and it suddenly rains, you're much, much more likely to get flooding than you would be in a regular time.
Okay, but I know you say that the showers in April, we always have them, but we do seem to have had particularly violent showers over the last week. Is that abnormal in any way?
It's probably more than we would get on an average 2 weeks in April. But at the same time, I wouldn't say it was a massive outlier or anything like that. Mm. We tend to get more rain over the winter, and it's really winter rainfall that fills up these reservoirs of groundwater below the earth. In kind of April and in the summer, rain will kind of help the environment, and it'll help farmers and it'll help gardeners, but it doesn't recharge these groundwater stores, and because most of it is either evaporated by the sun as temperatures rise, or it's taken up by plants as they grow.
Yeah, come to think of it, I was able to cycle in pretty much every day throughout the winter because it wasn't raining. Although it was cold, I can kind of imagine that we didn't get enough.
We got very, very little over the last winter. I think over the past winter, we only got 75% of what we normally get at this time of year.
Interesting. There's your wet weather gear information injection.
Information.
Yeah.
If you're curious, then the Environment Agency does publish monthly and weekly reports on the exact water situation in different parts of England and Wales, which are on their website. In the last one, Polly Chancellor, who's the National Drought Coordinator, said that the drought could actually last all the way until Christmas.
Blimey. I choose to get all of my water-related facts from Duncan because he does tend to be more reliable than any government agency I've ever heard speak. You're basically like my personal Michael Fish. Is he still around, actually?
He's retired, but he does exist still.
I miss the Fishster. He was good. Okay, shall we move on? I want to talk a bit about cookie lore, which doesn't sound as attractive as it... Well, it isn't attractive, actually, at all.
It's not edible.
It's very... quite dry, but it's actually very, very important to know about what's going on at the moment in the world of cookies. Cookies are those little tiny bits of information that a web browser or a website will store on your computer. It's not well, it is sometimes personally identifiable. Sometimes it's used, just giving you an identifier, so a website knows when you're coming back to it. Sometimes it's used by ad networks to track which sites you've been on, so it knows which site, which adverts to show you, because it knows which ones you've seen on other sites. There's a law coming into place, Liv, in about a month that's going to, could potentially shake up how cookies are seen by the public.
Yeah, I mean, the law has actually been in place since last May in UK law. It was initially an EU directive, which was put into law in 2009. It was brought into UK law in May 2011. And then we've had a year to get ourselves into gear to kind of comply with this law. And what they don't, what they're trying to do is make consumers, people who visit websites, actively consent or opt into non-essential cookies. So there's some essential cookies that you need just purely to function, to work the site. So like things like the shopping basket, so that you can buy something, you need to be able to store something in a shopping basket.
Or when you log into Facebook, Facebook knows that you're logged in. It knows who you
are.
Yeah,
it doesn't keep on logging you out and asking you to log in again. Mm. But there are non-essential cookies, which actually are fairly crucial to a lot of different things. So web analytics, Google Analytics uses cookies. Lots of advertising networks, so quite often the source of money for many online publishers. Any kind of social media plugins or kind of personalization tools that present you with a slightly different view of a website based on your preferences all rely on cookies. And so what this law says is that websites have to now in some way get the consent of their visitors. So what this will look like could take a number of different forms, but at its most extreme form, it will be a message that pops up when you visit saying, we are going to deliver you cookies, their way of tracking you so that we can deliver you better services. Tick here to opt in.
Now, I think this is the key word there, is opt in, as opposed to we're doing this if you don't want us to, click opt out.
Yeah.
Which has basically, in a way, been how it's always been.
That's how it's always been. So now people have to opt in. And if it's presented badly, there can be as much as a 90% drop off of people who've opt in, because most people don't even know that this, that cookies exist.
Yeah, if you tell somebody that an advert is monitoring its, you know, you're browsing from, you know, one site to another to another, and they say, yeah, do you actually want to do this? I think the average
most people say no.
Would probably say no.
And the kind of softer way of doing it is having some kind of sign that says, yes, this, you know, we need to have this because it makes the website, a web experience much better. We can able to, you know, give you free content by closing this message. You are kind of consenting to it if you want to find out more. And that's kind of the softer option, but it's kind of open to interpretation of what consent means.
Presumably you'd only have to do that once as well, because after that you could store a cookie that says you've agreed.
You would have to do that once, but this would have to, has to be on every single individual site. There's no kind of service that aggregates it, so you could just say accept all or don't accept all. You'd have to, on every site, technically on the 26th of May, they should be showing you some kind of messaging along these lines.
Now, something at the moment, a figure that's worth noting, is that apparently 95% of websites at the moment are not in compliance and could face a £500,000 fine if you're deemed to not be supporting this legislation.
Yeah, I mean, that's the harshest penalty. And there are sites that don't actually use cookies. Quite, if you've just got a blog and you don't have any kind of ads being served or anything like that, then you're unlikely to have them. But if you have any website that is commercialized with an ad network, you're quite likely to have cookies.
So I think there are some sites that have started to implement this already, if you want a working example. I know that BT, if you go to BT.com, I noticed this only the other day, if you go to BT.com, you get a little pop-up that quite explicitly says what they're doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you can, there's a little bar at the bottom that actually says, change my cookie settings. Now, I've never seen that on a website before. You know, you've always seen manage my details and little links to privacy policies. This explicitly mentions cookies.
Yeah. And I guess, actually, the language of the law isn't actually just cookies, it's local browser storage. So just by moving to HTML5 doesn't get round the fact that, you know, that round this cookie law, even though everyone's calling it a cookie law.
I think the way that we may see this manifest and what the average person will see when browsing the average website is more likely to be a box that says we're doing this, and you have a little dismiss icon.
Yeah.
So you're not saying I agree, I disagree. Basically, there's no way that you could police every website in the world, you know, and to be monitoring this. So what they really want to see from websites
it's kind of reasonable measures.
Is reasonable measures to be supporting this law. So if you have a banner that just pops up the first time you visit the site that says, we're doing this, dismiss, close, a bit like you see on some ads that sort of pop up, that is deemed as kind of implicit support for using cookies. And I think that's what we'll probably start seeing. It's something that, you know, Condé Nast as a business, you know, we are actively having to look into this. We've got basically, you know, a month to do something like this across all of our websites. And every other business in the UK is probably having a similar conversation. So it's something to watch out for. If you do start seeing these messages pop up, it's pretty much what you've been tracked for years and years and years and years and years, but now it's a little bit more obvious.
Why is the EU doing this?
Well, they really want to regulate the sort of data that companies are kind of gathering on you, and by dropping these little cookies on your browser, they can kind of gather information about what you do, what sites you visit.
So it's a privacy thing, essentially.
It's a privacy directive.
Because the EU has always been very, very hot on privacy topics.
Yes, they have. So this is about protecting people's privacy.
Well, we'll return to this around the time this law comes into place, which is scheduled to be the 26th of May, when websites basically have to comply with it. And we'll see what's been done. We'll have a look at what different websites are doing, and maybe even get a bit of feedback. In fact, if you have any feedback already, podcast@wired.co.uk. So earlier on in the show, we talked about the Against Violent Extremism sort of social network about bringing together former violent extremists and victims of violent extremism. And it got us thinking in the office that there are a lot of these sort of niche networks that have been around for many, many years that offer an extremely specific focus point for networking. We wanted to talk a little bit about whether there is an ongoing need for something like this, or whether Facebook actually these days is managing to accommodate even the most unusual of networks. Now, for something like the Against Violent Extremism, I mean, really, could that not exist on a platform like Facebook?
I don't think so. I think the thing about this network is it's got very strict controls about who can and can't see the content. And so people who are actually putting themselves quite a lot of risk of putting themselves onto a network where people can identify them and see them, they can set different levels of access to different people. And I think that's kind of really important in all this, is that, you know, you might want more privacy and you might not want ads delivered to you from Facebook alongside your, you know, here's a solution for your STD.
Cut rates on AK-47s.
Well, yeah, exactly.
There's an interesting network called Sermo, which is a network for US physicians. The idea being is that they can talk and share information about what's going on in medicine, and I wasn't sure whether it would include talking about patients. So if you have a particularly troubling ailment, you know, and you're, you know, a regular town GP, whether you could go on and discuss and get advice from other physicians. It doesn't seem to be like that. But again, this is the kind of thing that I don't think would necessarily work on Facebook, because would you really want to find your doctor talking about, you know, ailments that maybe you've actually had?
And also, it would be very, very easy for kind of pharmaceutical brands to infiltrate and say, you know, and potentially pose as clinical professionals saying things like, yes, you should definitely be using this drug, it's amazing.
Mm. I think that would probably breach advertising laws, but certainly for automated advertising, that could be an issue. I mean, you see this in Google. If you look in your Gmail, like, there's nobody monitoring the content of your adverts on a personal level, but the machine is looking for keywords. So if you've ever sent an email about, I don't know, your cat, maybe, I know this from experience, you can often see adverts for cat food. And, you know, that makes a lot of sense, because it's targeting it to your specific, you know, your specific interests, perhaps. And that wouldn't work on a Facebook network.
But I guess also with Facebook, you know, that's a place where you connect with mostly people you already know, or friends of people you know. And sometimes there's something that you want to connect with people with someone about that your friends don't share with you. And so there might be something very personal, something that you've been through that you know none of your friends have been through, or at least you don't want to talk to them about, that you know that there are other people out there somewhere in the world, and by finding a niche network, it's much, you know, you can obviously find a safe place to talk about whatever problems it is that you have, or, you know, interests you have.
And that's definitely something that the internet does best. It's fantastic at bringing people together who've got just one single strand in common, but is absolutely crucial to them and to their existence. And it helps you, people feel less alienated and feel less as an outcast in society, and all of that kind of thing.
Well, why don't we have a look at, we've rounded up some interesting social networks, and some of them actually border on the dating site, I think, but some more unusual networks. So we've talked about the one for US physicians. There is an interesting one called MyFolia, which is for people in the UK who are basically into gardening. And what I really like about this one specifically is that it has a top 10 plants of the week sidebar where you can look at what the most popular things that are being planted in the UK. Do you want to know what number one is right now?
What is it?
Basil.
Basil. See, I think
basil
that's interesting because
right
it illustrates another thing that's really important about niche social networks, that they can add little individual features that Facebook wouldn't be able to support.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't be able to support the top 10 plants of the week in the UK right now in a Facebook group.
No.
But MyFolia can build that in because it knows its users will want that and its advertisers will pay extra to get to those users who are particularly interested in those sorts of things.
You've been talking a lot about roses. Maybe you'd like to...
buy some rose fertilizer.
Buy some roses. Okay. So massage alumni, that was the one for massage therapists. Patients Like Me is an interesting one, which is a place, basically, if you're ill, to go and discuss your illness, which is kind of a fundamental requirement, I think, of us all from time to time to need to talk about illnesses.
And that's got to be a hypochondriac's hotspot.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I imagine there probably is. Divorce 360. I think this is a dating site, but it's quite obvious. It's for divorcees. To marry each other, I guess. There's quite a funny one, CCTV blog, which is a network for people in the CCTV industry. Although it's, yeah, that's based on Ning. Although I'm not too sure if Ning still exists. I think you have to pay for it now. But it's basically you can make your own social network.
So you can just sort of start one up saying, I'm going to write about badgers. I'm really into badgers. Let's make a badger social network.
But I think even more specific, like I'm interested in podcasts.
I've got a social network for you.
I'm interested in podcasts that only have hosts called Duncan and Olivia. And then, bam, we'd be number one. Another interesting one is Smoking Passions, which is a dating site and social network specifically for people who smoke. Strikes me as being a little bit...
It's who love smoking, apparently, rather than just smoke.
Should we pick one more off the list? I like this one. Stash Passions for people with facial hair. Fabulous facial hair, no less.
Well, is that one real?
That is real.
Liv added it.
I looked it up and I found it.
What about beards?
Oh, it's specifically moustache. There's some very good kind of, I don't know what they're called, handlebar and various other...
Moustache.
Moustache.
Well, if you've got a passion for a flash of hair on your face, now you know what to do. And I think we've concluded that there is still a need for niche social networks. And that there is a need to end our conversation about the aforementioned.
Before we do, if you're a member of a distinctly niche or slightly odd social network, we'd love to hear your story, like why you joined it, the kind of people that you've met through it. If you email us at podcast@wired.co.uk and tell us your story, then we might read a few out. And we're happy to remove your name, if you like, from your email in a future episode.
What about a network for people who like to smell their cat? That'd be an interesting one.
Would you join that?
Yeah, I'd probably start it. shall we move on and end the show with... we've got quite a lot of feedback, some really interesting things in our feedback this week. And the first is a voicemail calling us out on a mistake, I think.
Hi there. I was just wondering, in podcast 72, when you announced that Montreal was part of the United States, whether you were announcing a war between America and Canada or you were just confused.
Duncan, I think that was your fault.
Yeah, that would be me. I'm very sorry about that. I said the States when I meant
North America.
Should we hear back?
Should we have a flashback? Here it is.
If you must. In the United States, Montreal and Atlanta proved very, very powerful.
Yeah, that's wrong. Yeah, I think you meant North America. You meant North America.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Just got to keep things in check, you know. We'll beat you over the head with a shovel later.
Yes, thank you for catching us on that one. Its accuracy is very, very important. And we had some more feedback on Twitter as well, didn't we?
We did. Someone messaged me, actually, and said it was Caroline Beaven. She said that I always seem to manage to try and mention metal at every opportunity. Not precious.
She's just given you that opportunity.
I know. I wasn't sure if she meant precious metals, because we did just talk about mining asteroids for platinum.
I don't think she meant that.
No. Should we talk? Okay. Well, in that case, I've been enjoying the new Meshuggah album. Circles EP The Compass and the band The Contortionist.
What are The Contortionist like?
It's kind of progressive, slightly melodic, technical death metal.
Excellent.
They're just the bands I listened to this morning. Anyway, there you go, some recommendations. Liv, tell people how they can get in touch.
First of all, you can call us on Skype. It's 0208 123 0468, from a landline or a mobile. That's a UK local rate. Or you can follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK, and we've got a fantabulous Facebook page as well. That's facebook.com/WiredUK.
And on that note, we will see you again next week. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
I got squirted by a particularly juicy orange today. Mm. And all over my face.